Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
There's a place here at the table. Your coats go by the door. You can kick your shoes off in that pile on the floor. I hope you wore elastic, 'cause your waistband's gonna get tight. Take time's done, we're having a night.
Hey guys, it's Ari.
And Sophie. And you're listening to Having a Night, reviving the lost art of the dinner party. The art is coming back because we're vaccinated. I'm seeing vaccinated people indoors. I'm not afraid of it. I'm not afraid to say it out loud. It feels like a rebirth. I'm so happy. What about you?
No. Yep. I mean, eating indoors together is like the new doing drugs.
Is the new cocaine. Yeah.
I'm super excited, although it'll be really interesting to kind of track the weird kind of PTSD and like judgment that we all have
totally
now of each other and strangers because of what this, you know, storm has done to all of us.
I actually did eat indoors in one restaurant. That for some reason was still freaking me out. But I think now that I'm like, you know, more than 2 weeks out, yeah, I think it's just like needing to get over a lot of those fears and just accept like we are actually vaccinated. Like that is a scientific thing. We did it. Wow. God, thank you, science. Thank you, science.
I know. It's true. It's so, so profoundly amazing how quickly they did that. It's amazing. I just want to just say for 1 second, because I know you can relate. I also went out to eat inside recently and I thought I was a little freaked out, but I was more kind of overwhelmed or underwhelmed by, you know, for safety precautions, it was the place I went to, I think 50% capacity, maybe 30%. So it seemed so empty. And it's like automatically all of your associations from pre-COVID times of being in an empty restaurant, like this restaurant is bad. This restaurant is not fun. Should I be eating here? Those are just, it's like immediate. It's like Pavlovian.
Right.
You know, so trying to remind myself like, no, it's because of COVID. It's not like, oh, this isn't fun. This isn't good. This isn't going to be good. Why is no one here? And I imagine it's the same thing, you know, when theaters come back, especially with theaters, because the audience, you know, the energy of the audience, and I'm not even saying from a performer's point of view. I mean, that's obvious, like feeding off of it, but just right. Sitting in an audience, like kind of far away from other audience members.
Yeah.
That ain't fun.
No, but also particularly from the performer's perspective or right from the audience perspective of like the roar of the crowd does mm-hmm. something to your experience of to the communal experience.
Yeah.
So like having such a watered down version, of course, will change it. But I also feel like people are going to be so excited to be theater nerds and people who really love the theater are going to be so excited to be back in the theater that I feel like even if it's 30%, it'll still be, I'm going to be crying, nonstop weeping.
Especially if it's a musical.
Exactly. Oh my God. I love musicals.
Yes.
What did you eat this week? You're in Chicago.
Oh, wow. What an interesting question. Lots of cooking has been happening, which is great. You know, I'm sure you have this up in Millbrook or at your parents. Like whenever I'm here, even if I'm cooking something I've cooked a million times and I'm getting the ingredients from like Whole Foods where it's the same as the Whole Foods, you know, somewhere else in the country, it tastes better cooking in this kitchen.
Oh, I know.
You know what I mean? I'm like, what do they do to the water?
I said, isn't that so sweet? I think it is really just like there's something about family, about parents. If you have a good relationship with your parents, obviously I understand many people's relationship with their families would not make the food taste better, but it's so true. I'm like, everything here just tastes like childhood, I guess.
How about this? My parents are here today. We're making veal tortellini tonight.
I'm assuming that you're not grinding the veal yourself. You got ground veal.
A mixture of veal and like, there's maybe some mortadella in there and Parmesan.
Wait, just really quickly. So you're doing the regular tortellini shape, not a tortellacci.
Yes.
Got it. And are you going to do it like with sage and brown butter, or what's the thought?
That's great questions today. We're going to do it in broth.
Yum. Oh my gosh.
It's very rainy and cold here, unfortunately.
Okay. So speaking of dinner parties, I went to basically a dinner party on Saturday at our friend Claire Olshans. She has been on the podcast. Such a fun episode. Please listen to it about Dada Daily, which is her fantastic, delicious snack company.
Well, and it's also about what an insane tablescaper she is. So how did the table look?
The whole thing was very, very gorgeous. And the food was so freaking good. But what I want to talk about is it's not quite 100% asparagus season yet, but I had a smoked asparagus. It was like smoked and grilled. And it was so good because it was like the asparagus flavor melded with this much more robust flavor. I mean, of course, part of what's so beautiful about asparagus is like it is very delicate, but this was just like, it was packed a flavor punch. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. That's Guy Fieri.
People use exactly.
Donkey sauce.
Took me to Flavor Town. Very good. And it was also served next to a sous vide egg yolk, just the yolk. And it was fabulous. The egg yolk, I believe he had sous vide it. And then like, you know, when you crack open a sous vide egg, you can separate the white from the yolk really easily, which I was like, wait, I should start doing this because the texture, the consistency was very beautiful.
Yeah.
Really delicious. So that's what I had this week.
I want to know what you wore, but we should get to our guest.
We should get to our guest. Oh my God. I wish we could just hang with our guest that we have on today.
Oh my God. I wonder if he would want to hang with us. That would be such an honor. I mean, guys, this week we have on the incredible Sheldon Simeon, who you may recognize as a top chef contestant on two different seasons. He won fan favorite both times and I believe was eliminated in the finale both times.
Like, don't give it away.
But people know this.
Oh, I guess.
Yeah, people know this. He's a chef restaurateur from Hawaii, but he is, I think, 100% Filipino. He is just like truly such a talented chef and just fun-loving, chill, personable human being.
He, I think, brought such a smile to both Ari's and my face for the entire interview. And he has a new cookbook out called Cook Real Hawaii. And it's just so wonderful to see someone paying so much reverence to food that I grew up eating a lot of because I have spent a lot of time in Hawaii. But I think food that, as he says in this interview and as he sort of writes in the book, like when he first got on Top Chef, he felt like he couldn't cook that kind of food because it wasn't quote unquote serious food. And right. So now it's so exciting to be at a point in our world in which like this, in which we can all discover and admit that like this is totally serious food. And also, what does serious food even mean? But it's a wonderful book, wonderful, wonderful book, very inspiring. Yeah. So much fun to read. I feel like I want to cook so much stuff from it. And also you can cook a lot of the recipes in it, even if you're on the mainland, like you don't have to be in Hawaii to be able to cook these recipes. He has a lot of substitutions or ways that you can get some of the ingredients. So
it's super comprehensive, not only in like, hey, here's the best way I think to chop scallions, but also where to source ingredients. What are the substitutes? Plus the history of Hawaii and his own family's history.
I also think, you know, there's this, and he addresses this in the book, but you know, there's this fucked up idea of like, oh yeah, Hawaii is all about like spam and mayonnaise. And it is true that Hawaii is the number one consumer of spam and also mayonnaise in the country, but there's so much more to it. And like, if you think about the things that are growing there and the way that the fish is there, and I mean, it's just, it's so much deeper than what we think about when we just think about the surface of it. Am I making any sense, or should we just get Sheldon on here to talk about it?
Girl, you are, and let's get Sheldon on. So without further ado, we've got Top Chef Sheldon Simeon on the show.
Yay, here we are with the incredible Sheldon Simeon calling from Maui. So jealous.
Always away. Yeah. I get that a lot on these phone calls.
Yeah, I'm sure. It's probably very tiresome by this point. You're like, yeah, I live in Hawaii. Get the fuck over it.
It's like, yeah. I imagine if, you know, some people who are super tall and they're always like, the first thing anyone ever says to me is, what's it like being so tall?
Imagine like being from Hawaii. It's like, yes, the weather's always nice here. Let's move on.
Yeah. Yes. There are rainbows every day, and you can hear whales jumping in the background. It's all true, people. It is.
The rumors are true. Hawaii is paradise.
I do miss New York City, though. You know, for a while, I was there practically every month. Go eat pizza, go eat bagels, stuff that in Hawaii. I mean, there's good stuff out here, but it ain't nothing like it. Just simple things like that I miss.
Totally. Well, I feel like in a funny way, the things that taste amazing on the mainland taste terrible in Hawaii. Taste amazing in Hawaii tastes terrible on the mainland.
Agreed.
We have so many questions for you, and we're just like so moved by your cookbook. I think it's so incredible to read something that not only obviously covers the food, but also just this idea of Hawaiian food as the ultimate mm-hmm. fusion.
It just feels like in this time where there's so much, you know, people getting in trouble for cultural appropriation and all this cancel culture, mm-hmm. to inform your readers about where everything is coming from just makes everyone feel so much more connected to what we cook and what we eat. And it's just, and it's also so important just for our knowledge. So thank you so much for including all of that.
Oh, mahalo. Mahalo. Thank you for those kind words. You know, one of the things of we've worked, you know, 3 years on this book. And then at the end, it's like, what are we going to call it? And the publishers are like, let's say Cook Real Hawaii. I was like, wait, real is a kind of strong word to put, be putting it out there.
Yeah.
But, you know, as as they read through the stories and, you know, what we shared about like all these different parts of history, you know, that word real became the perfect describer of the book, and we put our hearts into it. And you know, it was a moment that we could shed light of the history and the uniqueness of Hawaii cuisine. Mm-hmm. And we're so excited for it. I'm ecstatic by the response by everyone.
Well, I was just curious about in your book, you do talk about your experience on Top Chef and how you had started out your experience there really cooking the kind of food that you thought you were supposed to be cooking, as opposed to mm-hmm. the food that you grew up with, the food that you actually enjoy cooking. And so what kind of stuff did you feel like you were making when you were on Top Chef and you were trying to be that kind of chef? And then was the change overnight? Was it like Top Chef ended and you were like, wow, I don't want to do that anymore? Or like, how did it pan out?
Yeah, well, luckily for me, I'm saying lucky, but I'm still scarred from it. I've done 2 seasons of Top Chef. Yeah, I think a lot of my friends and colleagues who've gone through the process would tell you, describe it in the same way. You're definitely scarred by it in a positive and weird negative way. But the first time around, right, like I was on Top Chef and I was intimidated by everyone else on there. These people has been cooking in Paris and New York City, and even as a chef out here in Hawaii, I look at these places, these big cities of how can a chef from Hawaii or the cuisine that I grew up with stand up next to the cuisine across the world. And it was always me coming up and mimicking, trying to kind of massage the food that we have in Hawaii to look like the food that you'd see in the cities. And the first time I went on Top Chef, you know, I did well. It would get you by, but when that moment where food needs to connect and where it really matters, you know, that's where I fell short. Then it was a huge learning lesson coming off of that first season of cook what is real to you. And, you know, just what kind of chef do you want to become? And the chef that I wanted to become was the food that I grew up with cooking, and be proud about that and be proud about the food that I put on the plate. That was the light switch when I got to the finale of the first season and I got eliminated for doing food that wasn't even from my heart. And I went back and I really thought about it and started to do the foods of my grandparents and do the food of my neighbors and my community. And I see how it started to resonate with everyone. And a lot of the times, the food, I could share a story to it. And this storytelling of it all became a part of how I cook. So when I went back on the second season of Top Chef, You know, that's what I did from start to finish, was just like cook my heart out and be proud about the food that we have in Hawaii. A lot of times everybody has this small little piece of what Hawaii cuisine is. And here I get to pull from all these different corners of the world, and it's still Hawaii. So yeah. That's the chef I am today, is like continuing to tell these stories of the food of Hawaii.
I spend a lot of time in Hawaii because my mom is from Oahu. And I feel like, you know, when chefs are trying to take Hawaiian ingredients, but make them right, that very like French or Western European, the simple preparation is always so much better. Cause it's also like, of course, just a piece of perfect grilled fish that somebody got that morning is always going to taste better than that piece of grilled fish with like a raspberry coulis on top or whatever.
Coulis. You know? When was the last time someone made a coulis?
2002.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm gonna do a special at the restaurant with coulis and tag you guys. Yeah, you're absolutely right of like how many simple preparations that we have out here, and we have an abundance of ingredients to choose from, where we had a host culture which is the most amazing thing to me, that was nearly perfect in my eyes. You know, we had the Kanakas, the Hawaiians that here that were so connected to it, their environment and the land, and they respected it so much that when it came to the end product, it was perfect. You know, like getting the perfect salt or treating it with so much care that it was undeniably delicious. And to have a host culture that sets the tone for everyone who came and made Hawaii their home, we're very blessed. And that's all we're trying to continue to do as residents and the people who live here in Hawaii, is continue that energy and that feeling that was set by the Hawaiians.
I wanted to ask actually about that. Like, has there been more of a move from chefs to go to like rediscover indigenous recipes? I mean, I feel like there are a lot of the indigenous ways of cooking are still around, right? Like emu, and like, I feel like there are a lot of preparations that are traditional, but is there a movement of certain chefs being like, okay, we're going to really try to rediscover the way that our ancestors cooked before the influx of all these other ingredients?
Yeah, definitely is. A guy is like Chef Mark Noguchi and Ed Kenny and Daniel Anthony. These guys are going back and getting the heirloom produce and heirloom plants and rediscovering it, and then just applying it to everyday life and really, really living that way that the Hawaiians did in a modern world, though. For me, like when it comes to Hawaii cuisine, I'm so lucky because people are already asking, it's like, when's the next cookbook coming out? And I was like, wait, pump your brakes. that's a little bit overwhelming to even think about that. But there's all these different avenues that you could take. You could take the indigenous cooking of the Hawaiians, and then you could take all of the cuisines of the Japanese. You could just take, okay, Japanese in Hawaii, Filipinos in Hawaii, and Portuguese in Hawaii, Puerto Ricans in Hawaii, Koreans in Hawaii, and make a full cookbook by itself. Yeah. I'm just so blessed to be a chef from Hawaii that gets to showcase that all the time. I'm so lucky that I get to share that with my kids, you know, who knew in this next few decades that a lot of those items and those traditions might have been lost. I have a small little, you know, some stories about simply as my adobo recipe in my cookbook, where my dad didn't learn the adobo recipe from my grandmother, and he was like super like sad about that. I was able to go to the Philippines and kind of discover this way to this recipe. And when I fed it to him, his eyes lit up, and I seen that he's like, okay, this is the way that our family used to make it. So it came full circle. And for me, that's a special thing when we can harness these traditions and pass it on and continue on. It's what I live for as a chef.
I wanted to ask you just as, you know, in terms of you as a chef and now, you know, as a celebrity chef and restaurateur and restaurant owner, when we think of people who, like, I'm going to use an example, like a Bobby Flay. We feel like, oh, we can recognize any of Bobby Flay's restaurants. Well, once he like opened that Spanish place that then closed, but like, we know it's going to taste like there's going to be a mango salsa and it's going to be like kind of barbecue-ish. Since you have dabbled in so many, you cook so many different types of food, like how would we recognize a Sheldon Sim? Like, what is your signature? What would you say is the thread that weaves kind of all of your restaurants and your cuisines together, just because you do so much, it seems like.
Yeah. Shout out to Chef Bobby Flay, though. We had a fun battle not too long ago. You guys can check it out if you want to check it out.
On his show.
On his, Beat Bobby Flay.
Oh my God, yes. I'm going to watch that.
For the record, we love Bobby Flay.
We love Bobby Flay.
Same here, man. Chef, love you, man.
Me too. But you know what I mean, though? That like he created a brand.
That's his lane. My lane is ultimately my life experiences through the lens of Hawaii. You know, like I love going traveling with my dad, which is not that often now, but I love it that it's not even a looking glass for him. It's practically like blinders because he's cut him open. He bleeds Hawaii, you know, 808. Yeah. That's his whole thing is like that. But the way that whenever he eats something or he looks at something, it's always described like, oh, that's kind of like the banana that grandpa used to grow in the backyard. Or, oh, that's kind of like the fish that we used to go catch down Kauai High. And it's the way that my restaurants are. It's a looking glass through the experiences of Hawaii. That's the common thread of it. It's usually based in community because they are the ones who support the restaurant. That's the circle. The ideas of the Hawaiians that you take care of the land and the land will take care of you. Whenever I make the restaurants, it's always going out to the community and how can I support everyone out there because that's going to make my restaurant successful. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the thread of it. It's I'm cooking food for my community, and if anyone who comes and visits gets to enjoy it, they have a piece of real Hawaii.
Mm-hmm. It's beautiful.
Speaking of real Hawaii, pupus is just, you know, pupus are the best ever, and I love that you have a whole section that's about
heavy pupus.
So
so good, so good.
Also, because it's like pupus is so much more fun to say than appetizers or hors d'oeuvres, but like it just really sums, it just sums it up. So would you break down for our listeners what a pupu is, but also what are like your top three ride or die pupus?
All right. So pupus is appetizers, but it's even a lot more than that. It's almost practically a meal, you know, in the idea of, you know, Spanish tapas or izakaya. Again, we get to pull from those different cultures. It's basically when you go to someone's house or you go to entertaining or a party, there's going to be food. If there's no food, you're doing something wrong in Hawaii. Like that's, if we're getting together, even if you have to open up a bag of chips with some something, that's going to be the pupu. But in my general description of pupu is, you know, small little bites of food that you can have while having a drink and having conversation. And here in Hawaii, again, we get to pull from a plethora of cultures. So pupu is all over the table. Poke, number one pupu for sure. Some type of raw fish. Again, here's an example of me looking at the lens of Hawaii, and it's the Hawaiian charcuterie platter. You know, we do smoked meat. So whether it's smoked wild boar, we do dried fish, like smoked marlin or dried skipjack tuna, aku. What else is on that charcuterie? Smoked octopus.
I have a very important question, which is, does a pupu, if a pupu requires a fork or a knife, is it still a pupu? Like, is it a finger food only situation?
Yes and no, because a lot of times pupus becomes the entree,
right?
Because there's so much on the table that it does become a meal. All my kids know how to use the chopstick. You learn to use the hashi at a very young age here in Hawaii. But you're picking away at all these different things, or you're making a small little plate that has all of these different items. Pupu is is a way to judge someone's party. I'm not gonna lie. That's straight up.
Yes.
My sons, you know, I have four beautiful children with three beautiful daughters first. But then I had a son, my fourth one. So on his first birthday party, which is a huge deal in Hawaii, you know, the idea behind the large gathering for the first birthday party was because in olden times, to make it to your first birthday, that was a huge feat. Mm. So we still continue that culture when your first birthday party. And we had 500 guests at my
son's. Oh, my God.
That's at my son's first birthday party. No, it ain't ice cream and cake and piñatas. It's a little bit different. But just the poo-poo line alone, we had 17 different items, you know, just from everyone, from friends and family, you know, donating things. So imagine you show up to a party and just the poo-poo line alone is 17 items. And then you get to the entrees, which I think I had 12 different entree stuff.
It's like the perfect Top Chef challenge. It's like, okay, hey guys, you're cooking 17 different poo-poos for Sheldon's 1-year-old birthday party for 5
months. Yes.
But then we have all these cultures. So, you know, like, everyone from their culture want to bring something, you know, like we have Portuguese sweetbread or pasteles from my Puerto Rican friends. They brought pasteles, and my Hawaiian friends made some smoked pork for me, and it just all comes together. So I take entertaining pretty heavy, which I miss the most in these times. I can't wait to get back to it, to entertaining. Maybe not 500 because first birthday, but we'll have a few more at the house.
We still haven't gotten your top three poo-poos.
All right.
You know, it might be too hard. There's so many.
I know that there's so many. Poke again.
Poke, number one.
Cubed up fish has to be, I like it simple. The poke needs to be simple. Fresh fish, maybe a little bit of salt, some seaweed, and some inamona, which is kukui nuts. Something smoked meat.
Mm.
Smoked meat is a generalized. A lot of times it's wild boar, wild pig here. And then number three, I'm going to let that one simmer as we go on and this conversation.
I can't wait to hear what it is. Hearing you talk about the way that you host, clearly it seems like you're very open to other people bringing things that they've made that like they want to contribute. Do you find yourself to be a control freak when you're hosting or in the kitchen at all? Or are you like totally chill and open?
That's a two-way street for me. I like, you know, the chef in me is always in me. So I like to be organized.
Right.
And I also overtend like overdoing it a lot of times. Like we end up with a lot of food than it needs to be, which is never a bad problem. So when it comes to that, you know, like I want to do a lot. I can't just relax. It's like, what else can we cook? I want to cook a lot more. But it's so normal in Hawaii that when you're coming over someone's house, it's a potluck. You're bringing something over. And I remember as a kid, like holding the pot in my lap or holding whatever we need to go with. We're going to auntie's house or we're going to a dad's friend's house. And I'm the little kid that has to carry the pan of food into the house. That's what it's all about. It's all about sharing. And a lot of the times you save your best poo-poos to share when you're going over to someone's house. And I love that.
A real spirit of generosity that I could probably use more of in New York City.
Don't bring anything. That's what Sophie's like. We will not eat what you bring into this house.
I'm really trying to let go of my control freakishness, but so far it hasn't happened.
It's difficult.
Yeah, that's how it goes. It's like we share here in Hawaii.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin Marshall credit card bill.
I want to jump back and talk a little bit more about emus and grilling outside. And just for all of our listeners, we weren't talking about cooking an emu. We're talking about IMU. It's a you know, a lot of people don't know. I don't know what our listenership is like in Hawaii, but
we'll find out. Oh my God. Wait, we have to give a really quick shout out to Melissa Chingoya, who is one of our listeners, and she lives on Oahu. So hi, Melissa. Yes. This one's for you.
Hey, Miss. Right on.
But so can we just, you know, explain to all of our listeners what a traditional emu is and how you build one, how many hours it takes, you know, what we would cook in it?
Emu is a traditional Hawaiian underground oven where you take porous lava rocks or river stone, and it is heated in a hole with the woods out here is kiawe, you know, Hawaiian mesquite wood or ohia. So it's heated until they're blazing hot red. And then it is covered with the stumps of banana trunks and a lot of tea leaves, which creates a steam pocket. And you put your protein down into this puka, into this hole. A lot of times it is whole pig. But the Hawaiians would add vegetables like sweet potatoes or bananas. And then you cover it up, more leaves, put a canvas over it or just some dirt, then you leave it. And it's as it's cooking, that lava stone is going to retain the heat. All the moisture from the banana stumps and the tea leaves are going to create this almost sous vide perfect environment where everything just cooks down slowly. Anywhere from 8 to 12 hours. And then you unearth it, and there's this beautiful, beautifully cooked piece of whatever you put in there. Now, traditionally, it's made for large gatherings. So like first birthday parties or high school graduation parties or weddings. Again, the luau's at the hotels, they showcase it too.
Oh my gosh.
It's funny. I feel like Francis Mallmann has like gotten all of this attention for, you know, he does like a very similar thing and it's incredibly beautiful, but it's like,
Mallmann's
not the only person who's ever done this.
Exactly. And something about fire, you know, that was how primitive that is. That was the way that everything does. You know, and the Hawaiians had so many different ways of doing it. Every culture food became, the food culture is based on necessity, right? That you use what you have around you. Hawaiians have lawalu, which is grilling or wrapping something in a leaf and cooking directly on top of the coals. They had drying, of course, with the abundance of salt that is around us, fermenting and curing, all of that stuff.
Like, do you like cooking outside? Do you like cooking on a beach? Or are you like, no, I live in Hawaii doesn't mean I have to do that.
Yeah, I love it. As much as I like to romanticize, yes, I do it at sunset every single night. Right. I am a chef. I'm a chef owner of a restaurant, a busy restaurant. So, you know, those days are far and few. But when we do cook out on the hibachi, I like to take advantage of that moment. And I'm grilling as much stuff I can put on that grill, knowing that that's going to feed me throughout the week, you know, leftover steak becomes steak sandwiches or stir fries, you know, smoked chicken becomes arroz caldo or juk, a rice porridge. I'm always thinking ahead of, especially with a family of four kids, you know, six of us in the household. Yeah. That's the way I like to think. But give me a beer on the beach, grilling. That's me. My wife is so funny. Like how you said, don't bring nothing to the beach or don't bring nothing to a party. If I'm down at the beach and I'm attending, I always find like somehow end up on the grill.
Yeah.
I'm always the guy like, hey, that's where I'm going to. That's where I'm the most comfortable.
Yep.
Yeah.
The vibe of your book, and it seems like the vibe of your restaurants is like,
pretty casual and like laid back island vibe. Do you think that like fanciness and also like we're talking about your cooking when you were on the first season of Top Chef versus what it's evolved into, do you feel like fanciness also has its place in Hawaiian cooking, or do you think all casual all the time is a better way to go? Do you like how I literally cannot even form a sentence right now? I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, you're good.
It'll take me 10 minutes.
Yeah. Well, that was the idea behind my restaurant Lineage. You know, it's in a fancy resort area. It's in a high-end mall that I literally looking out my kitchen window, staring into a Louis Vuitton store. I think if you can capture the feeling and its rawness of history in a dish, it can be presented well. And it can withstand the level of sophistication with all these other cuisines. You know, we're taking things and fermenting it for 8 months before you even had a taste of it. That itself is like the sophistication behind that. We're all using Hawaiian ingredients and techniques. They're presented well. We use tweezers and to plate up things. But Hawaiian cuisine and Hawaii cuisine can definitely be put on a platform and stand next to hot cuisine like French and Japanese.
Okay, I want to talk a little bit about some ingredients that we don't often get on the mainland, like taro, leaves. One big question for me is, what makes tea leaves so special? And let's say that we're here and like, I'm in New York, I can't get tea leaves. Would you suggest finding a substitution, or are you like, just don't cook that recipe?
My biggest goal for this cookbook is for everyone to be able to feel like they can cook these meals. And there's a lot of suggestions in the book, which is funny, because if you take it back a step, everyone who migrated here, they were kind of in that same scenario where they're trying to cook things from their homeland, trying to reminisce and create their own culture in Hawaii, but they couldn't access the ingredients that they had back home. So the recipes kind of changed and made it Hawaii. Although it's rooted in someplace else, it became its own thing. And that's, for me, the way that cooking is. Cooking is like you having a moment where I want to make something, you use what you have in front of you. Luckily, we have these amazing things here in Hawaii, but it shouldn't steal you from trying to recreate these recipes. Tea leaves. I love that the world is so much smaller than you think. You know, now there's frozen banana leaves in a lot of grocery stores. It just gives that earthiness and the greenness to when it's cooked in it. It has that aroma that it almost smells like you're going to a Hawaiian luau. Just having that burning aroma of leaves. Inamona kukui nuts. Just use macadamia nuts or something that's going to be very earthy. Just roast them super hard, because kukui nuts are very oily, they're very earthy, and they're very pungent. You're just trying to bring some earthiness to a dish. And then a lot of the cuisine of Hawaii is Asian based, and the Asian grocery stores has everything that we cook.
I mean, it's cool in a way. It's sort of like you're saying, like, you know, you can use kind of whatever you've got around. So it's sort of like putting a fusion on the ultimate cuisine.
Well, it's like how any cuisine gets birthed. Yeah, it's amazing. It's
a good idea. Yeah. I would love to make a cookbook, though, that dives into, you know, the indigenous things of Hawaii, because there's so many cool little things, and like the a'ama crab or the small little black crabs that you find in on the beaches, and all the different variety of bananas and taro. All of that, you might not be able to replicate it, but it could be a cool thing to educate people about.
On that sort of subject, are you on like the breadfruit train?
I've been on the breadfruit train, and I love it. I love that it's one of the most sustainable, you know, plants in the world. One tree produces 200 pounds. What else plants 200 pounds a year of edible food? It changes as it matures too. It can be this sweet, velvety custard when it's over ripened and cooked super slow. When it's green, it has a hearty texture like a potato, but unique. And then you can roast it and throw it into a fire, and it still holds its texture. Yeah, I love breadfruit, and I love discovering, you know, it's been eaten all over these different places, especially along that equator belt, you know, in the different countries.
Mm. What is the breadfruit for me and the other listeners out there?
I will send you the Latin scientific name. breadfruit is one of the canoe crops that the Hawaiians brought with them from all different parts of Polynesia. It was something that they cultivated, but it's starchy, like a potato. But the different varieties, some have large seeds. It's a cousin to the jackfruit.
I see. And
yeah, it's this beautiful thing that the Hawaiians used to cook with.
And it grows, I think, from what the limited amount of knowledge that I have about it grows really, really well in Hawaii. And I guess, like, for a long time, people stopped eating it, and so they stopped growing it. But it's, like, actually incredibly good for the earth. And as you were saying, like, it's a super sustainable crop. And it's very nourishing. So there's kind of this movement to revitalize breadfruit. Like,
I missed that train.
It's an important tree, man.
Yeah.
We are on the breadfruit train.
Breadfruit train.
Choo-choo.
Let go. Let's go.
Choo-choo, here we go.
So we're talking about your new restaurant Lineage and also your son's first birthday party and all these great celebrations and the kind of Hawaiian feasts that go along with them. What will you do? I'm positing that there might be a new celebration coming up in all of our futures, which is the pandemic being over. You know, there's going to be some people partying. What would you cook for this event? You know, what's your ideal? Are you like prepping a menu in your head? Like when you can finally get back out there, I'm sure you can't wait to like get back to work. But I mean, in terms of like a party.
Yeah. Well, luckily I've had some practice in this growing up and having these large parties, and I've been dreaming about those days to come. And, you know, I just want my garage to be filled with my whole family, but it'll probably be based in Filipino cooking just because it's one of those things that it takes a few days to get it all going. And then everything needs to be cooked down slowly. And there's just something about it when it all comes together. I'm starting off with, there's going to have a lot of drinks. My favorite drink is Paloma at the moment.
Have a good recipe for it in the book, right?
Yeah. And there's just something about tequila that livens up the party.
So true.
I agree.
So yeah. True. Yeah. We call these patio pounders. You can just like, it'll get to you. Sit in the back of the patio and you're done at the hour of it. But it's super fun. But pupus automatically on the table. So there'll be, you know, two or three different types of poke. There'll already be some cured meats on top of there. Then we go Filipino route. There'll be pancit noodles because we're celebrating. Asian culture is huge on noodles. You know, there always needs to be a big old wok filled with pancit noodles, Filipino Chinese stir-fried noodles. I'd love to make my family's pork guisantes dish, which is a tomato stewed pork that is cooked down very slowly in like an adobo vinegary sauce, and then finished off with green peas in the back, because after a night of drinking and celebrating, especially with the boys, there'll be like a pot of la uya, which is like a big beef shank or pork shank soup that is with just cabbage and potatoes. Just something about meat, cabbage, and potatoes in a soup. That's something that's gonna pick you right back up. So after a night of drinking, a big old pot of la uya with a lot of chili vinegar and rice. There's been nights of sitting in my garage. Like, I had friends growing up in high school that we'd come over, and even after college. They know to come over to our house because there's always something on the stove, and just nights of us just like are holding our bowls, just slopped over in the garage on my dad's house, my parents' house. And,
so good.
This is a photo taken at my dad's house, but this is a this was a typical weekend that would always be at my dad's house. It's like a huge spread of food down in the middle of the table, all my cousins and aunts and uncles and friends all hanging out at the house. That's what we do. That's
to great. Our listeners who can't see this, although maybe we'll post a photo, like a photo of the food for Instagram, but it's like the table is 22 feet long.
Yeah. You can't see the table because there's like so much
75
food on it.
Dishes. I mean, that is, that's epic to do that every weekend. Well, yeah, then you gotta allow a potluck because you have to let people, I mean.
Yeah. Everyone knows what to do, and when it comes to clean up or setting up and all that, everyone just does it. So
so great.
We're so special, awesome. So lucky to have that culture.
You're from the Big Island, and you now live on Maui. And obviously, I assume you've spent time on all the islands. But
yeah.
Do you feel like there are certain foods that certain islands do really well? Like when we talk about Hawaiian cuisine, especially if we're not in Hawaii, it feels very like, oh, Hawaiian cuisine, even though there's so many different arms, it's all the same on the islands, but that can't be true. So like, what are, do you notice differences?
Yeah, there are differences, you know, like the way the flavor profile is in on the different islands. So one in particular is a luau stew, which when I moved to Maui, they tend to be a lot more sweeter, this taro leaf stew. And the coconut milk was less, but it was a lot sweeter than when I how to do it on the Big Island, where it's a lot more savory. So there are those nuances. Right. And then just because of the demographic, like, oh, Honolulu is a restaurant scene. So like a lot of the food culture of the restaurants are viewed in Honolulu, you know, those old school diners that has been there for 100 years. And Kauai and the outer islands tend to have a lot more focus on the fishing and the hunting, just because in the rural areas that they are, it's still a large part of their lifestyle out there. But we're all weaved in this interweb of Hawaii for sure.
Yeah. Where are your favorite places to eat on Oahu? Because I'm going to be there in like a month and I'm so excited.
One of my favorites is Helena's. Helena's is an old school Hawaii diner serving traditional Hawaiian food. So you're gonna get kalua pig, and you're gonna get poke, and you're gonna get poi. But my favorite thing is pipi kaula, and their way that their style is when you walk into the restaurant, they're dry curing it over the grill, and it's hung up in the hoods, short ribs that is just drying, like lines of them. And they're slowly glistening and dripping. And then right before they serve it, they fry it up. So it's nice and crispy, but tender, juicy on the inside. And you eat that just simply with some raw onions and some pa'akai, some sea salt. And it's to die for. But
you don't even need any more recommendations. Done. Helena's pipi kaula. Wow. That's
there it is. That's it.
You touched on briefly before, which was like, you know, we were talking about how things just taste different in Hawaii. And
yeah,
I'm just interested in like, do you think that that is, of course, you know, the ocean there is beautiful and the land is wonderful, but do you think a part of that is also the reverence with which people treat the ingredients compared to maybe how some people treat ingredients on the mainland? Or like, what do you think contributes to that?
That ultimate respect that we have for food here in Hawaii. We know that being out here in the middle of the ocean, you know, being the most secluded landmass in the world, that for food we have here in on the islands, we have to take care of it. You know, it's kind of weird that we do import so much food, but if all of that stopped, you know, the food that we have here is so precious to feed our islands. So we treat our resources with care. We understand that how important our resources are from and how how it is. And that's that idea has continued on from the Hawaiians. And it is the song that we sing here. Take care of your land and the land will take care of you.
You know, I'm going there really soon.
Yeah, I'm so jealous.
I need to get more recommendations from him.
Yeah, you do. And you need to find him.
I know.
Get yourself invited to like a 500-person birthday party for a one-year-old. That's what you really got to do.
But yeah. He's on Maui. I'm not going to Maui.
Well, maybe you should. Change your plans.
I'm getting Maui'd.
Oh, my God. You know what? We forgot to ask him the chip question, but the last item on his poo-poo platter would be the fried fish, which is like, yeah, the chip of the sea.
Exactly. Yes, the chip of the sea.
Chip of the sea.
Oh, my God. Anyway, we just had so much fun talking to him. Just a beam of sunlight. Thank you so much, Sheldon, for coming on and for your book, which we both love so much. And to our listeners, we'll see you next week.
See you next week. We'll be on for Chip Hour next week. We love you. And we don't say this often enough because we try and be cool about it, but fuck it. Everyone says this. Please rate and review the show if you love it and you listen to it. It really actually does help us get more listeners because it changes the algorithm. And it's just a little ask, and you don't have to tell anyone. You don't have to post it on Facebook. You don't have to at us. Just, you know, give five stars. I'm like, hey, I love this podcast. It would really, really help us, and we appreciate it.
Thank you for saying that, Ari. I totally agree. Thank you, Colin. And we'll see everybody next week.
Bye.
You've worked hard for what you have, your money, your assets, your 401k, and home. Isn't it all worth protecting? Nearly one in four consumers have been a victim of identity theft. LifeLock Ultimate Plus helps protect your finances with up to $3 million in reimbursement. LifeLock alerts you to identity threats you might miss. And if your identity is stolen, your dedicated U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. Let LifeLock help protect what you've worked so hard for. Save 25% off your first year on LifeLock Ultimate Plus at LifeLock.com/aware. Terms apply.